Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I am joined by my other co-host, Alex Marcus, the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com and the co-host of the TV Break podcast. How are you doing, Alex?
Great, Justin. Happy 2022.
Yeah, I know. We made it.
More or less.
Wait, whatever getting through another year means anymore for the last 3 years. But we are here. I'm happy to have you. And we are also happy to have our other co-host, Noah France, who has co-hosted the Pod on the Rooftops podcast. Hello, Noah.
Hey, I too have made it.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad we're all, the three of us, are back again.
Somewhere.
Ooh, is this as a tease for our episode?
We will see, because we are, in fact, discussing on this episode the year 2021 in review, where we look back on the best in the movies from the previous year. This is a podcast where we typically discuss a recent movie release and then a larger topic related to it, but we wanted to just focus on the year 2021 and talk about some of our favorite films, some of our favorite performances. And to do that, we have four different categories that we're going to be running down today. They are our favorite big budget film, our favorite smaller budget film, our favorite international film, and last, our favorite performance, where we inevitably name more than one. But you know, it's a lot. There's a wealth of riches. So we want to give credit where credit's due. But I thought before we get into any of the categories, I just wanted to get your general thoughts, gentlemen, on the year in film 2021. We were a little more used to a streaming landscape this time, but we did maybe get to see certain things in the theater. So I just wanted to know, what was 2021 like for you? And maybe I'll start with you, Alex.
Yeah, so the story of 2021 in film for me is kind of not a lot and then all at once, even more so than usual, right? I mean, we always talk on this podcast about how, you know, the fall film season is my favorite time of year because so many interesting, fun movies come out. But I feel like the movie season in the whole movie year, in a lot of ways, really didn't get kickstarted until around September. This time around, I like tripled the amount of movies that I had seen from this year, from basically August to January. So that is kind of one of the most notable things. Also, the fact that, you know, last year we actually, on this episode, I was reminded that we subbed out our big budget film category for streaming category because, you know, big budget movies weren't really being released. And I think that's interesting to reflect on this year in two ways, because one, we did have a bunch of big budget movies. They came back and that was fun sometimes. But also, all movies are streaming movies now, basically. It feels like it's a very rare exception, any movie that you want to see at this point that's being released in theaters is going to be available to you on some streaming service within 6 to 8 weeks of its release. And that's just a paradigm shift that I think we're going to be seeing kind of permanently at this point. There was a lot of questions in 2020 about how will the changes that we saw in 2020 impact the landscape once, you know, the pandemic is over and things get back to normal. And obviously normal is not coming, at least anytime soon. So we're just in this new status quo shift. And
well, it's a different normal, basically.
Yeah. And I'm glad to say that means that you can see things in theaters now that you couldn't before, in ways that are sometimes safe and sometimes more stressful. But if you're responsible and you are honest about your risk assessments, you can probably see things that you really want to in theaters. But you also pretty much have the the ability to watch it at home if you're willing to wait only a couple of weeks, which is kind of wild to think about where we started with home viewing, where, you know, you had to wait almost 2 years before you could see a film at home when it was, you know, debuting at Blockbuster. And now it's only a couple of weeks. And so that's the big thing that I think stands out to me even more so than the films that we actually got to see, is just the complete paradigm shift that I think is here to stay at this point.
You know, that brings back a memory of me. I was absolutely flabbergasted when I saw DVDs for The Return of the King on sale 5 months after it was in theaters. That was like mind-blowing. Less than half a year? What? Is it Christmas? And that's, you know, that was only 17 years ago, 17 and a half years ago.
Oh my God, that's a full person. Like, the.
It's a whole adult.
Yeah, that's interesting. Noah, what about for you? What has 2021 at the movies looked like for you?
Definitely more movies. Movie watching in general, just anything old, new, like new releases, old movies, whatever, just kind of was forced into the background in 2020 just because everything else just kind of pressed ahead.
Yeah.
I was able to be more conscious this year about what was coming out, what was the buzz, seeing stuff in a relatively timely fashion. I've been able to catch up on a bunch of stuff the past couple weeks. And that's felt good. It feels good to be watching more movies again, even though my writing, anyone who follows my blog knows my writing has not kept pace at all. But I have been watching more movies, and that has been fun. And I was looking over my list today. I have a lot of material to work with when I do my top 10 list, which will be soon. There are two or three movies I want to catch before I do that, but that will come pretty soon. But I have a lot of stuff to pick from. There was a lot of stuff that I ended up liking.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I know for me, it's been, it was kind of strange this year. Last year, I felt like, you know, I had to kind of give up my love of actually going to the theater. This year, I was able to rekindle that, and I had some fantastic experiences watching movies in theaters. I think the other thing, you know, if I haven't said this before, but like one of the great things about going to movies is going to see them with people you care about, including one person in particular on this podcast. That meant a lot to me, going with other friends, going with family. I saw a lot of the Blockbusters with my family, which was great. But it also, you know, it also feels a little bit different. You know, it's different having a mask on the whole time. I'm finding the more I've done it that it's become more normal. I'm sure people feel that in general. But it's definitely something that feels different, but also feels like a return, to something that I really enjoy. And that's been really gratifying in 2021. I'll also say it seems like there are just more movies. Like, I'm seeing many more movies that are getting acclaim. And it seems like just the way the distribution has changed over the years, and how it seems to be, like you said, Alex, like a lot more things seem to be on streaming. I think that's just made it easier for things to be accessible. And because of that, there seem to be a lot more options in general, but also seemingly a lot of really good options from critics that I trust. And so it's made it harder and harder for me to kind of narrow down my watch list. I feel like each year it gets harder and harder, and you know, you kind of have to set a limit at a certain point. So that's been the other thing.
Especially when you keep rewatching House of Gucci, Justin. I mean, you gotta relax on that.
Yeah, what can I say? I just love cinema. I you know.
You're like a pigeon, you need to fly and spread your wings.
Is that really a line?
Are you doing your Jared Leto impersonation?
That is literally a line from the movie.
Are you two peeing arrabbiata sauce? Was he peeing marinara sauce, or was he shitting marinara sauce? I forget.
Neither of those things happen.
No, he had that line in the interview where he was like, I became so Italian, I was shitting pasta sauce.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I mean, he does actually pee at one point in the movie, and he refers to, he makes some sort of comments about It implies that he's actually eaten shit before, in a way that I don't know if he meant to say or not, but it's a whole thing.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Okay, I think what you're telling us, Alex, is we know who's going to win Best Supporting Actor this year.
I mean, listen, he was in contention. I'm going to be honest.
Yeah. Well, as a lone person of Italian descent on this podcast, I will be the one who's... I stand to be offended. But, anyway, yeah, this was so yeah, just to sum up, it's kind of been weird in some ways, even weirder than 2020 for me. But once again, it was definitely, I saw a lot of great things, and I'm glad that I had access to a lot of things, which, you know, in previous years, I don't know if I would have been able to get a chance to see. So that was a real blessing. All right. Well, without further ado, let's get into it. And we'll start with our favorite big budget film. There were quite a few to choose from. Many of these I shouldn't say many. Possibly we saw these in theaters. So I wanted to start with you, Noah. I'm really curious where you go on this one. What was your favorite big budget film?
I had two that I was considering for this. I ended up going with the last big budget film I saw, and that is Matrix Resurrection. Has been I'm one of the first people to shit on retreads, reboots, sequels that, you know, no one in the right mind would have asked for. And I don't think there was anyone a year ago in the right mind who would have said, you know what, the world needs another Matrix film. So I'm in general, I'm deeply skeptical of these sorts of returning to the well projects. But with that said, it's been a shockingly good year for that. You know, with this movie, Spider-Man No Way Home, and then Steven Spielberg doing West Side Story. Again, if you'd asked me a year ago, I would have said, no, who needs that? Leave it alone. Don't bother. But they all turned out really good. And my favorite was Matrix Resurrection. Alex, after he saw it, he wrote to us and said, it's like, how did you put it? It's like a Charlie Kaufman movie if he genuinely fell in love.
Yes, and directed Matrix.
Yeah, and directed a Matrix movie. And I completely, I totally get it. I love the fact that this movie really goes hard on being even more explicit about its themes, kind of in response to the fact that there's been there have been a number of waves of appropriation of the symbolism and imagery and the philosophies of the early Matrix movies, which we don't have to rehash in this podcast. But I do have to say, if there had to be another Matrix movie, I'm glad that it was one of the Wachowskis. And, you know, with a screenplay by one of my personal favorite authors in the business today, David Mitchell, going back and taking a swing on it and saying, OK, maybe we weren't clear enough about where we were going with this material, and just really going big on those themes and being very unapologetic about that. The whole first act is one of the most... I don't know if a film could be more meta than the whole first three quarters of an hour of this movie in terms of fame and stardom and being an artist, you know, being a creator, you know, and specifically tackling with the legacy, the cultural legacy of the Matrix and all of its various forms, like that one montage of people giving their one word summation of what the Matrix is about. And it's like 50 different things. I absolutely love that. It's definitely not a perfect movie. I would not argue. I would still argue there's, when you get down to the meat and bones of the story that it's telling, it's like, okay, did this story absolutely have to be told? Maybe this could have worked better in a different form. But minor quips with that aside, I like what they did with it. It was a very good time.
Yeah. I'm glad that you got a chance to see it. I'm sorry you couldn't join us for our episode about it, but I'm glad that this
that
is
was
one
a question
chose
of timing. I just didn't. I just had I had a huge time crunch, and I had to catch up with it later.
Yeah, right.
But I knew I made sure to see it before we did this recording because I wanted to be able to talk to it, and I ended up liking it a lot more than I ever thought I would.
I'm so happy to hear that. I really am, and I completely agree with everything you said. I'm gonna kind of jump the line a little bit and say that this was also my favorite big budget film of the year. For all of the reasons that Noah stated, all of the reasons that I previously stated in our hour-long discussion about it, so I will keep it brief here. But I'll just say, like, this is a year that had a lot of, like, very interesting big-budget films that many of them were very transgressive. Many of them were having kind of conversations with their audiences about expectations and about fan service and culture and all this stuff. And I think that Matrix just did it better than anyone did this year in a way that just is so impressive and so fun and so cool and so beautiful. And yeah, I mean, you guys know I like this movie more than anybody else in the world, I think. And I think that that's really special for me. And so it just, there was no possible way that it wasn't going to get on that list.
Yeah. And I have to say, it's nice having Neil Patrick Harris back. In a really good role for once. It'd been a while.
He's great as a villain. I mean, we saw that in Bond Girl. I wish he would get cast it more often.
He's really, it feels like he's almost become like a, he almost feels like a sneak attack at this point. Every now and then he'll pop up in a movie where you really aren't expecting him to be in, and then he's really fucking good in that movie. But yeah.
Yeah, I would say, like, for myself, I wasn't, like, I probably am not as big a fan of it as you guys are, but I recently was talking to my brother, who has been a guest on this podcast, and he saw it and he liked it a lot. And he was asking me to explain certain aspects of the plot. And I, like, was kind of doing my best to do that. And I think just in talking about it, I recognized, like, how good, and not just how good, but also how intricate it all is. And I still think the whole, I guess I don't want to give away too much, but the whole, like, shall we say, structure behind this Matrix movie is kind of ingenious, I think. And it's one of the things I do really like about it. And it's not at all what I would have expected from a Matrix sequel, even having seen the previous.
The other Matrix sequels.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's definitely something in its favor.
I had hoped to rewatch the entire trilogy before seeing this movie. I realized there was no way in hell that was going to happen. But so I did rewatch the first Matrix, and that was a great rewatch experience. And sure. I am going to go back just because I only saw those movies from start to finish once ages ago. I am going to rewatch both Reloaded and Revolutions and just see for myself what I make of them now.
They're better movies than you remember them being, but they're not as good as this one. So
yeah, I do want to revisit them at least once though, so that I can have that all in my head again. But yeah, no, yeah. this was my favorite. My honorable mention, but the second one I was considering was Dune, because that's where I thought you were gonna go.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that is in heavy. Both Matrix Resurrection and Dune are in upper level consideration for my top 10 list.
Both in my top 10.
I found Matrix Resurrection more impressive because it was going back to this well that's been picked over so much and still succeeded in giving us something much different and much more fresher and more interesting than I think we had any right to expect.
Fully agree. But Justin, I really need to know what your pick for this category is.
Yeah, so I did not go with Matrix Resurrections for this, but I did go with a film that we have discussed on this podcast, and that is Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings.
Okay, all right.
It's, of course, this is Destin Daniel Cretton, and I think in a year that was dominated by Marvel content, and perhaps even maybe a glut of Marvel content, maybe a little too much,
just wait really until felt...
What's that?
Just wait until next year.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds like a threat, Alex.
Yes, I know. I was just talking, just looking at the schedule recently, and I was talking to a friend. I was like, how are they going to do all this? Anyway, this film was really the film and maybe the Marvel property in 2021 that really rose above everything. And it stems from a technical level. The fight choreography is, I think, certainly among the more beautiful that we've seen in a Marvel film. I especially love the opening fight, the meet cute between Tony Leung as Wenwu and my new film crush of 2021, Fala Chen. that's just a fantastic scene, and it's so gorgeous to look at. And I think also there's been some criticism, maybe some of it warranted. I think we touched at least touched upon a little bit in our review that maybe there's like a little too much CGI in some of the action sequences. But I do think this film does a really good job with CGI in terms of the world building, in terms of the non-action scenes that use CGI, whether that's creating these fantastical creatures or just like, you know, some pretty impressive establishing shots. Like, these are all ways in which CGI can be used that feel more organic, feel like really using the power of that technology for something that can be powerful storytelling as well. And I think even so, from a technical level, I think it's incredibly fun to watch, but it's also just a powerful emotional story. This is really a story about reckoning with the good and evil inside of all of us, and about the complicated relationships that we have with our family, trying not to become our parents, but maybe recognizing that that's somewhat inevitable, coming to terms with our relationships with our parents. You know, for reasons I won't get into, that was really powerful for me, especially in this past year. I think I don't know if he's my favorite villain, but certainly Tony Leung as Wenwu is in contention for my favorite Marvel villain. He's just has a just amazing presence in every scene. He almost threatens to act everybody else off the screen. And
I think some would argue he does.
Yeah. I think just ultimately it gave me everything I wanted from a blockbuster, and with an incredible emotional punch as well, in addition to lots of actual punches. So yeah, just very satisfying, and definitely some of the most fun I had at the movies in 2021.
Yeah, I did really like that movie a lot, I will say. It's not quite on the level of Matrix for me, but I love this choice for you. I think that that's great. And I mean, a big budget blockbuster film that stars Tony Leung is just going to be a movie that demands our respect.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's a great origin story. It really is. It's like, you know, I feel like it's really hard to tell a good origin story these days because we've just seen it all before, and it's going to feel rote, and it's going to feel trite, and it's going to feel familiar. And I think this movie did a really good job just like leaning on its characters, leaning on its actors' charisma to just really kind of paint a picture that we're not quite used to seeing before while still really working inside the form.
Yeah, and it was one of the ones I wasn't quite sure about this year. Honestly, a lot of other films that I thought would be more sure bets, based on maybe the talent behind them, based on just general expectations, films like Eternals or Black Widow, which are films that I still enjoyed but just did not enjoy as much as this one. And I'd also maybe say the same about some of the TV. Some of the TV was awesome. Some of it maybe a little less satisfying. This was really the one that kind of made me say, like, yeah, I don't have, like, films like this are the reasons why I've not given in to Marvel fatigue yet. So,
yay. I want to give a couple of honorable mention shout outs. Just, I didn't want to say it in case you guys picked it, but, West Side Story definitely deserves to be in this conversation. Obviously it's not a superhero movie or fantasy epic, but it is an incredible big budget production, and it just looks fantastic and feels fantastic, and everyone but one actor is doing an amazing job, and it just is like a truly spectacular cinematic experience that I hope
let me give you a lemon so you can squeeze some juice out of that cut.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we'll be talking about West Side Story more a little bit later, I'm certain, but I'm just had to mention. I just had to mention it here because it's just like really fantastic. And the type of big budget movie that like at least when we talk about big budget movies, I think we often think about like explosions and martial arts. And it's cool to see a big, huge musical number that gets like all the trimmings, and it really, really works. And also like shout out to the last James Bond movie, which has been marketed to us for the better part of a decade, it feels like. And I was very ready to like not care about it, but they actually pulled it off. They made some pretty surprising choices, and it more or less worked, at least way more than I expected it to. So like, good for them.
Yeah. I would definitely agree on both of those movies. Those were also two very memorable film going experiences for me this year.
And like Spider-Man obviously goes without saying.
Sure. All right, well, let's move on. We're going to go on now to favorite smaller budget film. And this time I'm going to start with you, Alex. What was your favorite smaller budgeted film of 2021?
So as is often the case, my favorite smaller budget film is also my favorite film of the year. and that is The Lost Daughter. I talked about this briefly in our last episode. And I hope people have gotten a chance to check it out. I know a lot of people probably haven't. It is a bit of an intimidating watch, I think, for people who just see that, like, it's that poster of Olivia Colman just looking off into the distance on the beach, and they're just like, The Lost Daughter, like, oh no, what is this thing, you know? And it's not a super heavy movie. I mean, it, you know, actually it can be kind of heavy sometimes, but it's just fantastic. It's three fantastic actresses giving amazing performances in Olivia Colman, Jesse Buckley, and Dakota Johnson. Tremendous supporting cast of people. You're like, oh, it's that person, I didn't know they were in this, you know. And it's based off of an incredible author's work in Elena Ferrante. I don't know this novel in particular, so I can't say whether this movie is, you know, elevating the novel or vice versa. But I am familiar with her work. She's one of our greatest talents in terms of novels of the 21st century, especially in observing complicated relationships between women and internal lives of female protagonists that are not kind of afraid to be thorny and unlikable and difficult. She does that better than anyone else. And I think Maggie Gyllenhaal, who adapted the book for the screen, both as screenplay writer and director, just does a tremendous job creating a really, really fantastic sense of intimacy between these characters, a sense of sort of just anxiety and depression and compelling sort of emotional catharsis in various scenes. Just there's one scene that has been going around the internet a lot where Olivia Colman is just like going to watch a movie, and a bunch of punk teenagers, as a friend of mine would say, try to ruin the experience for her, and she just gets really angry. And that's like, and I totally get why that's been going around, because it's very relatable. Like, this movie in a lot of ways could be just like Olivia Colman sits down to have a nice vacation and keeps getting it ruined by obnoxious people around her, and I think everyone can relate to those feelings. But when you dig deeper into why she's there in the first place, it's not a mystery. It's not a mystery film, but it's an incredible character portrait, if nothing else. And Colman is just giving an all-time great performance. And yeah, it was like the last film of 2021 that I watched in 2021, basically. And it just was fantastic. Or maybe it was the first 2021 film that I watched in 2022. That could also be true. But in any case, it was a New Year's weekend viewing for me, and it just jumped right to the top of my list. And yeah, it looks fantastic. The casting is fantastic. The acting is fantastic. The direction is fantastic. Everything about it is fantastic. It's the best movie of the year.
Yeah, I can't wait. I cannot wait to see it. It will, obviously, it's on my watch list. Like, there's no way I'm not seeing it before the end of
2022.
Yeah, let's go with that. Yeah, and I'm really intrigued to see, you know, I'm finding more and more as I watch, you know, just watching a lot more movies recently, that the more difficult characters are the ones I tend to be more drawn to. And so I'm really interested to see how that plays out here. Have you seen this movie yet, Noah?
No, I've not had a chance to yet, but I have been hearing the buzz.
Yeah.
So I'm sure I will see it eventually.
I really think that, I mean, our taste doesn't always align, the three of ours, but I think that this is one of those movies that all three of us would really, really like.
Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like it. It definitely sounds like it.
Awesome. Also, I'm never going to turn down a movie that has Jesse Buckley in it.
And she's fantastic.
As I would expect. Yeah, so I'm going to go next, and I'm going to go with a movie that I know for sure. I don't know if Noah has seen this yet, but I also know that Alex is a big fan of this movie. I'm going with Licorice Pizza, which is, of course, the new
not
film.
Not available.
Anderson. Oh, no.
The International Film Release Nazi Strike Again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's the one movie I'm just going to assume it's going to take too long. I will not be able to see it before I make my top 10 list. I am absolutely going to see it.
Yeah, I figured, yeah.
But it was the same with Phantom Thread. It took a while before I was able to see Phantom Thread.
God, that's so disappointing. Yeah.
Those Germans, they have it out for PTA, man. What can I tell you?
I guess so. Wow.
Inexcusable.
This is, you know, maybe testing the limits of small budget. I looked up the budget today and I was shocked that it was $40 million. For some reason, I just assumed that something made on this scale couldn't be more than $20 million. But
Justin, neither pizza nor licorice prices are what they once were. We've got all this inflation, man.
It's true. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it looks, it's more of a scale thing. Like in terms of the way it looks amazing, but and it will come as no surprise. People, the listeners of this podcast will know that Paul Thomas Anderson is my favorite working filmmaker. The last, 4 years before this, he made my favorite film of that, whatever that year was. So, you know, I still have a bunch that I'm going to see, so I can't say for certain right now whether this will remain my favorite, but right now it is my favorite. And there's just so many reasons to love it. I honestly have a hard time articulating one thing about it. I love the fact that it's a two-hander and has amazing performances from pretty new performers. I actually might be, I'm not sure. I think it might be Alana Himes' first, like, at least feature film performance.
It's her first performance outside of music videos.
Yeah. And I ended up watching a few Haim videos recently, and it's amazing just like the vibes I was getting from her that were so similar to what she gives in this movie, which was really fun. I think also it's just the texture of it. The time and place, the details are so, I don't know if I could say they're right. I'm not well versed in what the San Fernando Valley was like in the early 70s in LA. But whatever it is, it feels right. And that's just down to like everything from the look of it to the haircuts to the fashion, you know, even just like the little moments within the feel like with all these child actors and how they try to get gigs. There's an audition scene that I think is just really funny and just feels completely right, even as it ends up being kind of heartbreaking. PTA, and this is something that I don't know if he gets enough credit for, but certainly something I've noticed in a lot of his movies, is he's very good at creating lived-in environments, lived-in relationships, and doing it very economically, doing it within like the span of a short scene. Even just the appearance of a character on screen for the first time can tell you so much about where they are, like their mental state, what their relationship is with other characters in that scene. And it just does, he does so much character work in such a short amount of time. And it's just the kind of thing you want to drink in. I also want to give credit to this film for having maybe the suspense scene of the year. In which I don't want to give away too much for Noah until he sees it, but let's just say it involves maneuvering a truck.
Oh my God. And how incredible is that sequence?
I was watching this in the theater and literally like had to like, it was like bringing, like tensing my body almost in a fetal position, waiting for the relief to come, which eventually it does. But, man, it is incredible. It's like, I don't know if anyone,
PTA meets Baby Driver.
Well, I don't know if either of you have seen Sorcerer, the William Friedkin film from the 70s, which is about like driving these trucks over these really treacherous bridges. And like, that's what I thought of. And I was not expecting that in this kind of ramshackle coming of age film about growing up in the early 70s. So, it's just incredible all around. I'm going to see it again at some point. Not because I don't think I love it enough, but just because I want to spend more time there. And I just think it's wonderful.
Yeah, I fully agree. This is definitely in my top 10 of the year. It's actually my number 2. So it's just below The Lost Daughter for me. I second everything that you said. It's just a really fantastic cinematic experience, top to bottom. Just like the ensemble that PTA pulls together is just out of this world. And these two leads, the fact that it's their first performances ever, like it's Cooper Hoffman's first film performance. It's Alana Haim's first acting performance, and they're just fantastic together. They're just so great and so charismatic and no, never at all. And it just like the ingenious idea by PTA of doing a teenage coming of age story and like a mid 20s coming of age story on top of each other, mm-hmm. and like what that does to both of those stories, how they reflect and refract each other, is just so interesting and compelling. And I've heard the film described as not a not recapturing what it was to be in the San Fernando Valley in the 70s, but recapturing what it feels like to remember being in that place. And I think that's incredibly correct. Mm. It's just like everything about the way that time moves and the way that relationships form and the way that events kind of sprawl out and pop up and disappear, it all really does feel like a collective memory of a time more than anything else. And it's just, and that could be so nostalgic and treacly and terrible, but it isn't at all. It really is kind of like warts and all, but with this sort of interesting reverence, while that is constantly being undermined in really fun ways, you know, and subverted in fun ways. And so, yeah, it's a remarkable achievement, and it's really fantastic.
And I will say, Noah, if you needed a reason, if you still are out on Bradley Cooper, I think this film will make a really compelling argument.
He's so good. Like, he just got nominated for a SAG, and I'm so excited.
There are certain circumstances where Bradley Cooper is acceptable. Like, well, as I would say CGI raccoon, where I don't have to stare at his punchable face.
He's so funny in
Licorice
Pizza.
Maybe it was David O. Russell the entire time. We just had to get him away from everything, from everyone.
I think it was. I think that's entirely correct.
Well, let's go to you, Noah. I have no idea where you're going with this, so I'm really sitting on tenterhooks. So
I'm going to stick with when I first saw this, it instantly became my favorite movie of the year. It's still within contention, although I wouldn't be able to pick my absolute number one out of a hat just yet. But I'm going to go with Bo Burnham's Inside, which I know, kind of stretching the definition of movie here, but there was just nothing else I've seen this year that just felt so personally attuned to myself. Like, I wrote to Alex after, like, within the first 10 minutes, and I was like, okay, who gave Bo Burnham permission to mine, like, my deepest fears and insecurities and then to make a movie about them? This is outrageous, and I feel violated. But in a good way. It's just, there's so much going on there. Some of it constructed, you know, some of it intentional. And I think some of it also not necessarily intentional, but a byproduct of the fact that Bo Burnham is, you know, another case of a guy who started off as something of a young YouTube star before getting into like performance comedy and then getting into actually doing movie roles. In various forms, like he's done the past few years now. Yeah. So it's, you know, he comes at the internet and at the relationships between being a modern day artist or content creator and the audience from a way that's very unique to, or a way that kind of very much started with our generation. And he is of our generation because we're pretty much the same age, because he turned 30 in 2020, the same that I did. And he wrote a song about it. And it's one of the most amazing, but also kind of heartrending things that I saw in a movie this year. I talked about this a bit also when we talked about Tick, Tick, Boom, because Andrew Garfield also sings a song there about turning 30, ironically turning 30 in the year that I was born. Now that I think about it, but there's so much metatextual stuff going on with Inside that I keep, every time I think about a part of the movie, I keep coming away with a new angle and a new perspective on both on what he's trying to say, and I think of just what the nature of the special brings about through its very existence. You know, like the meta commentary of him doing like commenting on his own music video and then commenting on himself, commenting on the music video, then commenting on himself, commenting on himself, commenting on the music video. And it's just such a perfect encapsulation of kind of just the doom loop that a lot of online content creators find themselves in of, I have to keep rehashing the same thing over and over and over again. And it's like this endless circle of hell. and I can't do anything else because I'm going to lose my audience and I'm going to lose my source of income. You know, a lot of content creators have started to really open up about this. And some of them handle it, I think, in mature and productive ways, and some of them handle it very poorly, as we've also seen the past few years. So just it's an incredible it hit me on a very personal level. It's the ideas and topics are stuff that are absolutely fascinating to me. And it's just it's so insanely creative. The number of ways he finds to, you know, just using a single room. And really, I mean, not cheap. He doesn't have, he's not using like a, you know, a handheld camcorder from 20 years ago. Like he obviously has top notch filming and lighting and sound equipment, but still like the ways he finds to create these incredible visuals just within the same four walls over and over and over again and make it seem, sometimes making it seem tiny and claustrophobic, and other times making it seem like he's actually in, you know, a theater in front of a large audience just by using lighting and sound effects. There's just an incredible amount of creativity in every one of the songs and set pieces. And it was both a hard experience, but also a very stunning one in that sense. So it's still definitely top five, and it's within in consideration for my film of the year, but I'm going to wait until I've seen a couple of other movies before I actually make that pick. But it was an easy pick for me for a favorite small budget film.
Yeah, I had a pretty good feeling that you were going to bring that up. If you weren't, I was going to mention it as an honorable mention, almost as like a micro budget film, because it truly is like the smallest budget possible. It's just like he's in his own house alone.
That's kind of why I picked it too.
I know. Of the three of us, I think you really nailed the definition of this
small,
one.
Small budget.
I can't imagine that the equipment that he spent, like that he paid to make that, is like more than $1,000. So I'm like very curious what his production budget is on that film. But yeah, I think
that might have been stuff that he already owned from like other projects too. You know.
Yeah. But it's really, I think that it's a necessary text for the era that we're living in, and I'm really glad that it is being represented here.
It is absolutely a time capsule. It is, and I think a very, very important one. I think its importance is only going to grow. Whether or not, and I've seen some criticisms of the movie or of some of his, or in some of the jokes he tries to do that, and that I think are fair, but still, it's just as a whole, it's this incredible experience that just captures so much of this current era that we're living in. Yeah. And like I said, he turned 30 the same year that I did. And made a heartbreakingly true song about it.
Well, yeah, another one I need to catch up with, but I can't wait to experience that sort of cathartic existential terror as someone who is older than Bo Burnham. Oh, boy. all right, well, let's go on then, shall we, to Best International Film. And this really gives us a wide swath of things to cover. I think I'm going to actually start this time, because I'm going to probably go short on this, because this is a film I have talked about on this podcast before. I'm going with Quo Vadis, Ida. This is, I believe I talked about this on our In the Heights episode, I think, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes, I believe so.
But this is a movie from Bosnia and Herzegovina. It's from Jasmila Zabonic, who is, I think I had mentioned, is tapped to direct an episode of the upcoming The Last of Us television show. This is, of course, a film about, takes place, the backdrop is the Bosnian Civil War in the early to mid-90s, specifically a sort of fictional retelling of the Srebrenica massacre, which was a very infamous event from that conflict. You know, again, I don't want to rehash too much about it. I do think one of the things I really love about it is the way that it does such a good job of sort of pushing off this inevitable tragedy simply because it seems unfathomable. It seems impossible that it would be allowed to happen, not just by the perpetrators, but by the people who are put in place to protect it from happening, specifically the NATO peacekeepers who are there to ostensibly, you know, lend aid and are unable for several reasons, many of them bureaucratic. And it does such a good job of sort of creating the sense that, no, this can't happen, even up until the last moment. Until that last moment, it sustains that tension throughout the film. And when it happens, it's like floodgates opening. It is not an easy film to watch. I do think it's not necessarily very explicit in terms of the violence. A lot of that is more implied. And I would argue that makes it more terrifying because we know that this stuff actually happened. And I just think it's a reminder that this stuff is still happening. And it can be difficult to fathom, but that's kind of the point of this. Like, this is something we do need to fathom if we really are going to pretend to care about human rights violations in this world. So this film has really stuck up there for me. And that's the why I'm going to go with it. I also did really quick want to thank both of my co-hosts because your recommendations last year, for you, Noah, it was Corpus Christi, and for Alex, it was A Son from Taiwan. Corpus Christi is from Poland, and both of those films did not end up in my top 10 for 2020, but they were both made my honorable mentions 11 through 20. So I wanted to thank you for that. I did get around to catching up with both of them and was really impressed by both of them. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you caught up with them. That's great.
And I'll pass it over to you next, Noah. What did you go with for international film?
I went with another small film that it is making the international rounds, but it's definitely not very widely available. This is yet another movie that I was able to see because of the fact that I'm involved with the Nippon Film Festival here in Frankfurt, which is the conduit for especially a lot of smaller Japanese movies to get an international release. And I went with the latest documentary from a guy named Thomas Ash, formerly Ian Thomas Ash. He's an American who's lived in Japan for, I think, like 25 or 30 years at this point. And he does, generally speaking, he does documentaries that deal with social issues, that deal with the health system in Japan and social issues related to that, especially ones that touch on the notion of family or civic responsibility. And his latest film is a film called Ushiku. And Ushiku is a detention center in Japan for asylum seekers, for refugees and asylum seekers who entered Japan and then tried to claim asylum or refugee status and whose claims have been denied. But Japan just doesn't deport them. The problem with this is when you delve into how asylum seekers and refugees are treated within Japan and by the Japanese government, you start to become confronted with a lot of the inherent xenophobia within a lot of Japanese society and especially Japanese policy, where it's just either you're Japanese or you're just not welcome. And of course, he's coming at this with the perspective of, you know, a person who's also, you know, a foreigner living in Japan, but, you know, maybe has been able to gain an acceptance because he's a white man from, you know, the United States, that a lot of these asylum seekers are simply not granted. Japan's approval rate for asylum cases is like less than 1%. Like, it's absolutely minuscule. It's like a handful per year, and the rest are simply soundly rejected, and they're placed in these detention centers where they're basically denied, like, they're given the absolute basics in terms of food, and they're denied even basic medical care and what makes this film so impressive is these detention centers like Ushiku are completely closed to the public. The visitors are allowed to go in and visit the people being detained there, but journalists are not aren't allowed in. Video and photographs are not allowed. So he had to sneak cameras into his meetings to speak with the inmates there. So it's very much like it's very much a guerrilla style documentary film, where he's able to bring a camera in and speak to, sometimes with a translator, sometimes he's just speaking with them in English. Or in some cases, these people are fluent in Japanese, like they lived and worked in Japan for a while until their status was revoked, and then they were put into these detention centers. So a lot of them are fluent in Japanese and, you know, just want to go back to their lives, but they're not allowed to. And it's just, it's a series of really horrifying stories about how they're denied basic human rights. In some cases, he's able to show footage that was sneaked out of people being beaten and abused by guards, which, of course, is then flatly denied by the detention center. No one is ever held accountable for them. And at the same time that he's sneaking in and doing these guerrilla interviews with the detainees to gather these stories about what's happening, about the very real human rights abuses that are going on at these detention centers right now. He also, because as he was filming this, the pandemic started. And so he also ties it into how in some cases people were able to be granted leave to leave the detention center and go back to living with friends or family for a time. In some cases, those have been extended. In some cases, they've been revoked and the people have had to return to the detention center. And he also ties that together to his efforts to get a handful of MPs in the Japanese parliament to engage with the issue and to demand that the ministers in charge of these facilities actually provide for the resources and the treatment that they claim these people are getting. But once you hear the testimonies of any of the detainees there, it's clear they're not getting what the government claims they're getting. They're basically being tossed in there and are being denied even the most basic rights or care, and are being told, well, if you don't like it, just go back to your home country. And they all repeatedly say, like, we can't. We will be killed if we go there. Like, that's why we're here. And the response from the entire system is basically just, we don't care. You're not Japanese. We don't care. What are you even doing here? It's a hard watch. It's really horrific because a lot of the stories, and you know, there are some, like, that one of the people who eventually is able to get a sort of parole by the end of the film. So it's kind of it's there are some positive indications that the film is able to tie into by the end. But he has a health scare where his family is convinced that he's about to die, and they have to basically, like, it takes almost an entire day for his family to be able to get him out of the detention center and to be sent to a hospital so that he actually gets treatment. But even then, like, they're only just able to get him into the hospital, but they can't actually go into the hospital with him and find out what the doctors talk to him about. But there is some indications that the pandemic, at least in a few cases, were able to get people better conditions than before. And there is a really great scene where we're basically seeing a section of, you know, one of the ministers in charge of the facility is giving testimony or giving a statement to a committee of the Japanese parliament. And one of these lawmakers, one of these MPs, who joined up with Thomas Ashe and his crew and said, no, this is this is important. We have to do something about this. It's all in the very clean and respectful, you know, form of language that, you know, you expect from like a parliamentary hearing, but it's clear that he is just hammering her. Like, he's not letting the person off the leash, and he's just firing question after question. Why haven't you done this? Why haven't you done that? You promised to do this. You promised to do that. The budget says you're spending money on this. What have you actually spent the money on? And it's like, it's actually real life. It feels like a gripping, dramatic scene that someone like plotted line for line, but it's actually real and it actually happened. And it's one of the more gripping scenes in any movie that I saw this year. So it's like the very fact of the film is kind of amazing. Like, it's one of these guerrilla films that was not supposed to exist, that, you know, the powers that be would have done everything. And actually at one point he was denied, Thomas Ashe was denied access to the detention center because they started to suspect that he was bringing in cameras and filming testimonies from the prisoners. And he had to like work through legal channels to get access and be allowed back into the facility at some point. So there are scenarios where for a period of time, he could only talk to these detainees on the phone. So in those cases, you have a black screen and you're just hearing the audio of the phone. So like the fact that the film exists at all is amazing. The effort and care that went into getting these testimonies and creating this film is amazing. And it's about an incredibly important topic that is being deliberately ignored by an, you know, ostensibly in air quotes, you know, modern civilized democratic nation. And yet one that's willing to, you know, much like a lot of the detention facilities in the US, you know, when you scratch just a little bit beneath the surface, you find these really horrific human rights abuses that are being deliberately ignored, because if anyone talked about it, then they'd have to address it. And that's what the people in power don't want to do. So that's my pick. It's really, like I said, it's only, you know, Thomas Ashe's movies are always well received at Nippon, and he's able to show them at film festivals around the world, but they are very, very small budget films, and he doesn't have like a studio backing him up. So I'm not sure at the moment if or when the movie would be generally available in either the United States or Europe. But I mean,
yeah, while you were talking, I was able to do some research, and it currently has only been released in film festivals, and it doesn't have any release scheduled yet for either digitally or in wider audiences. But it definitely seems like something to keep an eye on. It does have a website, ashikofilm.com. So people should check out that website and maybe just keep checking to see for updates of when they could watch it, because it definitely seems like a very vital and important film for people to see.
And he, like, that's what Thomas, like, I've been able to meet him and talk to him a couple times at the festival. Like, he deliberately looks for these topics of, like, what are things that people just are not talking about at all?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, on the other hand, that does make it hard to get wider distribution, because if there are topics that no one knows about, that means studios are going to be like, well, no one's going to pay money to see a movie about this. So that's why I try to push his movies whenever I can, because he does really important work, you know, even though if he's not yet gotten the audience that I think he deserves.
Yeah, I'm curious, Noah, not knowing a lot about this filmmaker, but just that you mentioned that you talked to him. Do you know, has he faced any pushback as a result of this movie? I mean, are his films?
Oh, yeah. No, like the detention, like several times he was banned from entering the detention center because they either suspected or discovered in one case that he had a camera. And it was like, hey, you broke the rules. You can't come back. And he had to like work with a lawyer to say, well, no, you can't ban visiting rights from these people. That's literally against the law.
Do you know, like, has he had any, I guess I was thinking more of like post distribution or boycott or anything like that?
Nothing official, again, because that would be, you know, if the government were to go heavy on that, that would be acknowledging the problem, you know. That would be drawing attention to it. That is, if he comes to the festival again at some point with another movie, I could ask him that.
I'm always curious just when it comes to filmmakers who are also activists in terms of, you know, what challenges they face to having their work seen.
I mean, I'm not aware of anything on the scale of Lauren Poitras, who knows that she was on a number of government watch lists for her work. And that's the reason that she now works out of Berlin. And out of the EU, so that she can't be as directly targeted by the NSA. I'm not aware of anything on that scale.
Gotcha.
But of course, he's yet to do something that provocative, like trying to take on one of the largest intelligence agencies in the world.
Yeah, I guess
maybe
so.
Maybe one day.
Yeah. So we'll finish with you, Alex, for this category for international film. What did you go with?
So I have to come clean and say very embarrassingly that it turns out I have not seen a single international release from 2021 at this point. I know Quo Vadis, Aida, you consider that a 2021 release. And I will say that President Barack Obama also agrees with you, because he listed it as one of his top films of 2021. So you are in good company. But I personally wouldn't classify it as a 2021 release for a variety of very semantic reasons that only I care about. So as a result, I haven't seen any films that were released from international cinemas this year. I've seen tons of films from other countries this year, including some that will definitely be coming up in our part two episode, but none of them were from the year 2021. There is a list of 7 films that I am very excited to see that I have been wanting to see all year long, pretty much, and I still have not gotten access to them. And so in lieu of a film to talk about, I'm just going to give you a list of the 7 films that I'm most looking forward to watching from this year that I have just not been able to see, because, you know, if you were not in one random theater in, you know, East New York, you could not see several of these films until probably closer to Oscar season. So the films included Flea, the Danish animated documentary film about an Afghan refugee, which seems fantastic and would probably make a very good double feature with the film that Noah was just describing. Petite Maman, which is the French follow-up from Céline Sciamma, her follow-up from Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which, of course, everyone really, really liked, including me from a couple years ago. The Worst Person in the World, a Norwegian film by Joaquin Trier, who also directed Oslo 31 August, which got a lot. I never got around to seeing that, but I know a lot of people really liked it. This movie has been getting tremendous word of mouth, just kind of like a great sort of like quarter life crisis film is what I understand it to be. I really am looking forward to that. Pedro Almodovar's latest with Penelope Cruz, Parallel Mothers. I really, really want to see that, but haven't been able to yet. The Arpikidapang Wersuk Thakul film, the Thai director, he made a new film with Tilda Swinton in Colombia called Memoria. People might know him from Uncle Boonmi, the film that kind of made a lot of noise out of Cannes a number of years ago. That movie seems incredible, and they're basically kind of touring it city to city right now. It's like impossible to watch, but it seems really cool. And also, two, not one, but two films from Japanese director Ryusuke Hamaguchi. The first is an anthology film about love and life in Japan called Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, which is apparently really fantastic. And then his other film that he also released this year is considered by many critics to be the film of the year, Drive My Car, which is like this three-hour epic car riding movie, I guess. I've tried to like learn as little about it as possible because it just seems like a really cool movie that I've heard that the less you know, the better. Not because there's like twists or stuff, but just it's a good film to just like let unfold. And people say that the lead performer, Hidetoshi Nishijima, is also really fantastic. There's been a really big push to try to get him an Oscar nomination, which may or may not happen. You know, the Oscars tend to be a little bit more internationally focused than the other awards bodies, so it might happen. But yeah, so that's my long list of seven films that I've been really, really, really wanting to see. I feel like there's a really strong chance that out of those seven films, like almost maybe even all seven of them could end up being in my top 10 list of the year based on the way critics have talked about it. But I haven't gotten to see any of them. And so, yeah, I guess, like, you know, follow this space and you'll hear eventually if I liked them.
Yeah, all of those are ones I want to catch up with. And I'm honestly would have to check to see which ones are considered 2021 and which are 2022 at this point. It's getting really dicey.
Yeah. But all of them are considered 2021 because all of these have had qualifying releases in New York and LA, at least like actual theatrical qualifying releases. Yeah. Which, you know, those qualifying releases last year were a little bit more complicated because a lot of them, it was just like, well, it's like international, like it's like digital cinema for a week. And that was our qualifying run. So it's like, well, does that count if it's like, you know, but anyway, that's not the case here. All of them definitely were released in New York or LA for at least a week or two.
Cool. Yeah, we talked about some of those films, I seem to remember, during our fall movie preview. But yeah, it'll be maybe a little bit longer before we actually get to see them.
Yes. So I apologize. I really wanted to do my homework on this one, but just all of the movies I wanted to see, just I couldn't see.
Yeah, that's how it shakes out sometimes. So. All right, well, let's move on to our last category. This is our favorite performance. I think I'm going to start with I'll start with you, Alex, just as a little, you know, just to shake things up a little bit.
Sure.
Who did you, I'm curious, like, just how did you, just knowing based on previous episodes we've done, how did you structure this? Like, did you have one performer and then a bunch of honorable mentions, or how did you approach this?
Yeah, so people who have listened to this episode in previous years know that I usually go crazy on this category a bit. I just, like, make a list of, like, my 10 favorite performances. I tried not to do that this time around and tried to really rein in and be a little bit more, disciplined in assessing the year of performances. So I went with my favorite, one favorite performer, and then I went with one male and one female performer as runner-ups. Just to kind of like spread out the love. And honestly, even if I wasn't breaking it into like female and male performer, I think they would still be my two runner-ups regardless. But I just wanted to have that balance. So the favorite performance I'm honestly not going to talk a lot about because I already spent a lot of time this episode talking about. And it's Olivia Colman in The Lost Daughter. I think this is absolutely my favorite performance of the year. It's my favorite Olivia Colman performance, honestly. It's so fantastic. She deserves like every award, but honestly, like, it's okay if she doesn't get it because she just won all of the awards a couple years ago for what is genuinely not as good of a performance as this one. So we could just all retroactively be like, yeah, but that was just for The Lost Daughter instead. That's fine. She's just so fantastic, and I've already talked about why. So I do want to share to shine a little bit of light on my runners up. And those would be Rachel Zegler in West Side Story, who I think genuinely gave one of the best performances, not of just of this year, but of many, many years. I think she is a megawatt talent. I think the way that she nails the singing and the dancing and the emoting is just incredible. I think she is she has like an anchor around her around her ankle throughout most of this film by being tied to a certain male performer who is lacking in
by being
charisma.
Tied to a tree.
Yeah, just like she's just like her scene partner just really left a lot to be desired for me in West Side Story. But I always believed what she was selling me because she was so fantastic. And I really think she's an incredibly exciting young performer. Like, I feel watching her the way I did watching Timothée Chalamet in Call Me By Your Name, just this kind of like electric screen presence
I think high comparison coming from you.
I know. And I truly mean it. Like, there's just like an electric screen presence to her that was just she was just so in the moment in every moment. And just this movie asks her to do so much. And she just nailed every single beat of it. It's an incredible find by Steven Spielberg. Like, they cast her when she was, I believe, 17 years old. And it just is, she's just incredible. I can't wait to see what she does next. And I really hope that she lands an Oscar nomination out of that performance because she's just so fantastic. My other runner-up is from another one of my favorite films of the year that has not been mentioned at all so far in this episode, so I'm glad I'm getting the chance to bring it up. And that's Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog, which is definitely in my top 10 of the year. It's Cody Smith-McPhee, who plays a very inscrutable sort of character in this film, a character who we really he's kind of presented early on as this sort of like this artistic soul, right? This person who is the son of Kirsten Dunst's character. He's kind of a bit of a punching bag for Benedict Cumberbatch's character for a part of the movie anyway. And I don't want to give too much away about where this film goes because I think a lot of people still haven't seen it, and I really recommend people seeing it. But the film kind of hinges on some pretty interesting choices that Cody makes. And he's an actor that I've seen since he was a little kid. He's been in a lot of things. I had no idea he had this sort of performance in him. And I just am really, really just blown away by what he's able to do in such small, intimate moments. And just he's just always unexpected in this role in ways that just really, really are necessary for the film to work the way that it does. And it does so fantastically. It unravels in such a powerful and unexpected way. And it all is kind of hinged on Cody's performance. And he just knocks it out of the park. And I just can't speak highly enough of it. And I can't speak in any more detail or else I'll kind of give away some pretty important moments in the film that I think are best left experienced for yourself. But just like truly phenomenal. Just a young actor just coming in and just saying, like, this is actually what I can do. I know you think that I'm just, like, Nightcrawler and, like, whatever, but, like, I can actually do this. And just like, oh, cool. Glad to know that you could do this. Can't wait to see you do it again somewhere else.
Wow. Paranorman himself.
I know. I know. And, I mean, you know how much I love Paranorman, and he is very good in it. But, you know, this is just, like, this is other level stuff from him.
Yeah.
And I just like, and the movie doesn't work if he doesn't pull it off, and he pulls it off better than I could have possibly imagined.
Yeah, still as yet unseen by me. So we'll report back, but I have a funny feeling that that Power of the Dog will contain some of my favorite performances of the year, but we'll see.
Yeah, and it's on Netflix, along with
yes,
The Lost Daughter.
Yes, The Lost Daughter, yeah.
Netflix having a really good year for me in terms of Creed films.
Any others or?
No, that's I'm limiting it to just those three. I'm trying to be responsible.
Yeah. Sorry, I've been conditioned at this point. Just I'm like, I think maybe I'll go to you next, Noah, for this. How did you approach this this category?
I didn't have much of an approach. I just went through my list and thought, what's one performance I feel like talking the most about that I haven't talked about already? Mm-hmm. So I would like to give a blanket shout out to, again, with one exception that Alex noted, pretty much the entire cast of West Side Story, which was just solid top to bottom. But especially Mike Feist and Ariana DeBose, which were just absolutely groundbreaking performances in roles where there was a very real danger of any effort to revisit the classic performances from the original could have just subsumed whoever tried to redo them, but they really make the characters their own. So those are my shout outs. The performance that the performance that I ultimately ended up finding the most interesting, is in the movie that I most recently saw just a couple nights ago, and that is Kirsten Stewart as the Big D, Princess Diana, in Spencer. And Spencer,
you have to stop calling her the Big D, Noah. This is not the first time he's done this in my presence, and I will not stand for it.
What can I say? I am what I am. Anyway, so Spencer on the whole is definitely in heavy contention for a spot in my top 10 list, because I thought it was a great film. But it lives and dies by Kirsten Stewart's performance. And that's, I think, what set the performance for me a little bit apart. As opposed to a lot of the other movies that are in heavy consideration for my top 10 list, which are more ensemble pieces, or there are multiple performances that are of note, this is very much a movie that because it's so centered around Princess Diana, Kirsten Stewart has to be on the ball with her performance, and she absolutely is. She's been blowing me away in movie after movie after movie after I finally decided to, you know, grow up and not be an ass and hold the Twilight films against her, which a lot of people did. But she's proven repeatedly that she absolutely deserves to be in the conversation of one of the top actresses in the game today. Because this is especially, you know, the Diana story has been worked over so many times now. And, you know, we have The Crown doing their take into two, and we have a god-awful musical that's trying to become a thing that also came out this year.
Well, so, it failed.
It's definitely
Became a thing. I think we could at least say that much.
I guess. Not the thing it wanted to be. But this is definitely one of those characters, one of those figures that has become so worked over. You could very easily seeing it kind of overwhelm anyone trying to find a different take on it. And who could end up kind of, you know, disappearing or maybe not coming across as well. But she's just, you can't look away from her from the beginning to the end. Like, she really captures the physicality, the mannerisms of Diana, but you're still able to recognize it as Kirsten Stewart giving this amazing performance. She doesn't disappear into, she embodies the character without like just completely vanishing into it, which I think is an important distinction to make. And it's just the scene that I keep coming back to. Have you guys seen this? I know Alex has.
I have not seen it yet.
Okay.
Yeah, but yes, another one that I will certainly be watching.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it very much, you know, the beginning of the movie says this is a fable taken from a true tragedy. That's very much the case. The whole film feels like it's the way that, you know, mist and fog and the muting of the colors, it makes it feel like you're watching an old fairy tale, like on an aesthetic level, but obviously more like a horror story fairy tale where you're trapped in a repressive and exploitative system that will not let you break free no matter how hard you try. And it's a borderline horror film. In so many.
I think it's explicitly a horror film. Like they're definitely going for at least a ghost story kind of feeling.
Yeah. But the scene, honestly, the scene that I keep coming back to and that had the biggest impact on me is a nighttime scene, you know, filmed basically in candlelight of, you know, Stuart playing with, of Diana playing with her sons. You know, yes. She wakes them up Christmas Eve. To just spend some time with them and play a game with them, to just really just be themselves, you know, because the sons, I have to say, you know, I'll also give an honorable mention to the boys they got to play William and Charles, because holy crap, it's hard to find really good child actors, and they're not as central to the film, but the fact that they work so well and are so believable and they have such an incredible chemistry with Kristen Stewart. Yeah.
I think that the boy who plays William is really great, and I think he gets a little bit more to do than the other one, and I think that the tone of voice
when he says you got me a stuffed lobster as a gift is just so funny.
Yeah, it's cute.
But it's
he's a cute.
It's this absolutely amazing scene, and the way they bounce off each other, and you get the sense of, you know, she's managing to steal these moments to just be a mother to her boys, which, you know, in a lot of ways, that's all that. And I, you know, I think Diana herself, you know, is very explicit about this. A lot of times she just wanted to be a mother and, you know, enjoy time with her family and with her kids. And she could not have that so much. And that's very much the emotional center of the movie, is her just trying to have some time with her kids on what's supposed to be a holiday all about family. And that's the scene for me that just crystallized everything that makes the performance so powerful. I would not be surprised if this is, I would be flabbergasted if Kristen Stewart is not at least nominated for this performance. And if she is, I think she has a very good shot at winning.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into this obviously in a few weeks when we have our Oscar nomination episode, which But she was, up until a week ago, considered the front runner for Best Actress at the Oscars. But then she missed at the Globes. She didn't even get at the SAG Awards. She didn't even get nominated at the SAG Awards. So that's kind of throwing that into question a little bit. But up until that point, she was considered the front runner because it's a really fantastic performance. I've seen this film. I like the film maybe a little bit less than Noah does. I do like it. I don't quite love it, but I do love her in it. And I'm so happy that you put a spotlight on that one particular scene, because that's one of the scenes that really jump out to me as well. Especially because as a performer, you know, Kristen Stewart, she's our age, right? So it's not like she's like a young kid.
A little bit younger.
But
I
think she's almost exactly our age. I think she's maybe like a year or two younger.
Probably close.
The point being is that like she's not a young person anymore necessarily. But I always think of her as this like person, like this figure of like youthful, you know, independence or whatever.
She has that energy in a lot of her roles.
But to see her as a mother to children, and not even particularly young children, right? Like William in this is about like 13, Harry's maybe about like 8 or 9. That's like kind of the vibe that you get. So to see her with like these, you know, genuine, like kind of like older children, as a mother was just something that I've never seen her in that position before as an actress. And I thought that she did such a fantastic job. She had such a great rapport with those kids and a great chemistry with them. And you really got the sense that they were having this like really powerful moment. And it was fun and it was light. And it also brought out an aspect to her character that the film oftentimes didn't get a chance to highlight because of all of the anxiety and depression and swirling kind of stuff going on around her. So it was just this really great sort of like anchoring of her character to be like, look, all of this other stuff is awful and terrible, but like at least she has this connection with these kids, and if she can just get out of this place and take those kids with her, then maybe her life will be a little bit better off. And I think that she really plays that really well. And I think just overall, she's really excellent at capturing this like this feeling of like being in a deep depression and falling into an anxiety spiral and what that must be like while the eyes of the world are watching you.
It really brings you into that headspace. And the movie itself just really brings you into that headspace of what must it feel like to feel so trapped in this kind of situation and where everything feels like a threat. Just the way certain characters looking at Diana is framed by the camera feels like a threat.
She also has a really great scene on a beach with Sally Hawkins that I will leave it at that, but it is really excellent.
That definitely runner up for best scene of hers in the movie after the candlelight scene. That was just, it was so adorable too. Cause the whole scene, the gag is they're pretending to be soldiers talking to each other as like officers and soldiers. So they're ending every sentence with officer, sir, soldier, sir. And it adds it's almost like another fantasy level. Like they're playing a game while they're trying to have this genuine connection with each other.
Yeah. It's a really great performance.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I definitely look forward to seeing it. I also just love that we're doing this podcast now and just thinking about Noah from like 2008 when I first got to know him and what his opinion was on Stewart as an actor, and to think like, you know,
Justin, no, we don't talk about that. It's in the past. Let the past die.
Fair.
Kill it if you have to.
And by the way, I did watch all of the Twilight movies this year for the first time, and she's actually not bad in those movies. She has some very good moments in them. People were really annoying at the time. Those movies aren't the best, but there's a couple of them are actually good, and some of them are bad. But she's always, her and Robert Pattinson are always just like really going for it, and you gotta respect it.
Well, I will take your word for it. I think I'll stick with their post Twilight projects.
I'm just saying, you watch those movies and you're like, okay, I could see how they would turn into like art house darlings. This makes sense.
Oh, okay. For my performers, I did have a few honorable mentions, which I'll just briefly mention. Because I didn't do a lot. I try to go with people that I don't think are going to get attention from the major awards. Although sometimes I'm incorrect. So, you know, who knows? So some quick honorable mentions. One of my favorite movie star performances of the year, Idris Elba in The Suicide Squad. I just love him. It's just so satisfying to see him in a lead role. That like makes use of his talent finally. And he just nails it. One of the things I love about him in that role is just the humility, is the, like, when he admits he's wrong and just the grudging way in which he does it is so fun to watch. I just love him. I also a smaller film, that I really enjoyed a lot, that I know, at least, Alex, you have seen, it's the film Rocks, and specifically the lead performance, Bucky Becrae, and the sort of major supporting performance from Kosar Ali. I just think very different kinds of performances, but, very lived in. Again, they just kind of feel like people who have always existed. I think they have to play a lot of interesting dynamics and a lot of different modulations within scenes, which are really fascinating to watch. And I just think they nail it. And, you know, they're, again, kind of newer actors. So I'm really fascinated to see if they end up doing anything else after this. And then the last one I'm going to mention, another, I guess you'd say, sort of blockbuster performance, but two supporting performances from The Matrix Resurrections that really have stuck with me. That I think we mentioned in our review, Jessica Henwick as Bugs and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II as quote unquote Morpheus. Again, just very fun performances. I just think this film really benefits from having that sense of fun. And again, they're fun in very different ways. So I just wanted to give some love to them as well.
You know, I would add on to that. I would also like to give a shout out to Keanu Reeves' work in Matrix Resurrections. I really like the way he kind of tries to do older and more disillusioned Neo.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
It's him flexing different acting muscles than the one he's used to such great effect in the John Wick movies. Mm-hmm. And it's he feels like a more, because, you know, Neo is
a different kind of old and broken down, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. And you get like the broken down part really works. Like those scene, like that scene with Neil Patrick Harris when he asks, like, am I crazy? That hit hard. That was a heavy moment.
Yeah. So now that I've teed it up for my favorite performance, this is, I guess, 3 for 3 in terms of lead actresses that we're going with for this category.
The only right answer is an actress when you ask what's the best performance of the year.
I'm going to go with Morfydd Clark in the film Saint Maud, which is a movie that I think has gotten a decent amount of attention, certainly within the cinephile community, maybe not as much with the awards bodies. It came out, I guess it technically is a 2020 movie, but it only got a release in the United States in 2021. I think it was originally slated to be released the previous year. And I just love what Clark is doing this. I really love a lot of things about this movie. I think this is something I would point to as a sort of alternative faith-based film, because it very much is about that, but not in a way that you would expect from, let's say, a pure flicks movie. It's kind of whatever the opposite of that would be. But it is very much about that. And it just shows that you can explore faith and religion in, you know, in a multitude of different ways. It doesn't just have to be something that caters to or panders, I would say, to a certain audience of believer. This is a film that's very much about doubt and about how doubt can be essential to the experience of having faith. And I think that's what Clark is really bringing to this performance. She is someone who has gone through something traumatic, which we learn more about as the film goes along, and it has really colored her perception. But you also get the sense that she's kind of been like this a lot of her life, and you really sense that she has sort of carved out her own version of, I guess, specifically Catholicism in this case. She has sort of developed this way of communing with God that is very specific to her, but still feels she feels very devoted to. But what's interesting is see the ways that she sort of modulates her performance to show the doubt creeping in, and then to show the way that faith kind of resurges within her. And she's not just, this is a film that also is in a lot of ways about mental illness. It's about subjectivity and perception. All these things are kind of woven together, but I think what we never lose is the sense that she is an inconsistent character. She always seems like you always understand kind of where she's coming from, and you feel for her, even if sometimes it's hard to sympathize with her necessarily. It's also just such a different performance from Clark based on what I've seen. I'm mostly familiar with her in period pieces. One of her first movies was Love and Friendship, where she, I believe, played Kate Beckinsale's daughter in that. And that was a very fun performance. Another very fun performance in The Personal History of David Copperfield, playing a kind of different character. And I don't think, if I didn't know her name before I saw this movie, I don't think I would have guessed it was the same actor from those other two movies. This is much more intense, something that is just like the kind of performance that just like commands your attention at every moment. And she just has to go through such a range of emotion and really show like the highs and lows of you know, faith and doubt and ultimately making a decision, which I will not spoil, but let's just say it may be a decision that she regrets and how that's conveyed on screen. And it's just, this film would not have worked, you know, like you were saying, Alex, about how Power of the Dog really relies on the Cody McSmith McPhee performance. I think this film lives or dies on the Morfydd Clark performance. And not to say that it isn't a skillfully made film from Rose Glass, but it really benefits tremendously from Clark in the title role, because she's basically on screen for almost the whole time. Just a really amazing performance. I don't think it's going to get any near the amount of accolades that it really deserves.
Yeah, I know that it has definitely been popping up in critics, some critics' end of the year lists and things like that. I've heard a bunch of people really appreciate it in the way that you have. So I think that that's really great. It's unfortunately not getting that wider kind of appreciation at the end of the year that you would hope. But, you know, I think that a movie like this, it's great that it's getting championed at all, because it's definitely something that I've been hearing about so much over the last few years since it debuted. I feel like it debuted at TIFF in 2019, and it's been just kind of like slowly coming and not coming since then, but yeah, I know I have been very anxious to see it, and it's not my kind of movie exactly given what I've heard, but you and other people that I really respect say that Clark is just so fantastic that you just have to see it. So I definitely have it on a list somewhere to catch up with, because yeah, it seems like it's a really special movie. I will say that I briefly sat down to watch St. Francis and thought I was going to watch St. Maud, and those are very different movies, so don't get them confused.
All right, well, I guess...
And I just want to, before we end, just point out that this year I had the fewest performances of all of us, so I think that, you know, I deserve some sort of compensation.
Oscar for less work done. Goes to Alex.
Yeah, what goes around comes around. Before we end, just any kind of final thoughts, anything, any sort of general thoughts about 2022 perhaps?
Oh, 2022, I can't think about at all yet. That's, I mean, I know we're like already halfway through the first month, but that's not ready to think about a new year.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like that meme of, that meme from, which Captain America is it? The second one. It's that still shot of Anthony Mackie with Chris Evans about to come up and overtake him when they're jogging. And on Mackie's shirt, it says, "Me still processing 2021. And on Captain America's shirt, it says, "2022 about to start."
Yeah.
It's kind of where I am.
I feel that. Yeah.
But I will say, in terms of the year that we've seen, like there's a few movies that we haven't really gotten to talk about at all that I think are worth talking about very briefly, at least, as some of my favorites. Luca, the Pixar film. I think a lot of people when that movie came out was like, oh, it's kind of like lesser Pixar. It's cute, it's fine, but it's nothing special. I loved that movie. It's definitely in my top 10 of the year. I think it's such a special film, especially if you can look at it through rainbow colored glasses, if you will. I think there's a lot there. I've talked in the past about how much I love Tick Tick Boom. That has been an enduring love. Dune really stuck around for me. I think that's it was a great movie when I watched it, and I wasn't sure if it would be like top of the year kind of great. And it is. It's right up there for me. The Last Duel, the Ridley Scott film from earlier this year, a lot of kind of like commotion around its release because people didn't go out and see it, and Ridley Scott was mad because he was like, people just look at stuff on their phones now, and then everybody was like, oh, he's old, why do we need to care about him? Like, whatever. There's a bunch of stupid people talking about stupid stuff. I finally saw The Last Duel. It's fantastic. It's so good. It's so much better than I thought it would be.
Is that streaming anywhere right now? Because I do want to catch
streaming
up on that one, too.
In the U.S., it's streaming on HBO Max, so you can definitely check it out right now.
Okay. All right.
As part of HBO Max's deal with Fox Films. Okay. So it's going to be there for a few months at least, and it's really, really worth seeing. It's this very interesting story told from three distinct perspectives, and if you like a movie like that, it's just great. It's got some really fun performances. Jodie Comer is just like out of this world good. Matt Damon is playing just like the most obnoxious guy, and he does a really good job as just being really annoying and unlikable. Damon-y. Yeah, it really feels like it's a very self-aware thing where he's just like, yeah, everybody keeps, all of a sudden nobody likes me anymore. What if I play just like a giant jerk that nobody likes? Like, let's just do that. And he does, and it's great.
He did one take, then Adam Driver off screen just yelled, "More!"
Well, and like the fun thing about his character in it is that so it's told from three, it's basically one story that's told from three distinct perspectives. Matt Damon's character, Adam Driver character, and Jodie Comer's character. And Matt Damon's character is a character whose perspective you watch first. So you watch his entire kind of his entire take on what's been going on in the film for the first act of the film. And then you see Adam Driver's character's perspective, and then you see Jodie Comer's character's perspective. And each level into that film, you get realize more and more what a terrible, annoying person Matt Damon is. Like, Matt Damon, when he's the teller of his own story, he presents himself as this very kind of like a pious person who's very respectable, and then like as you're seeing him from other people's perspective, you see like actually he's maybe the worst character of all of them. It's like Rashomon deals a lot with like, you know, storytelling in a way that I don't think The Last Duel is doing explicitly. It's more of an implicit thing, but yeah, people have referred to Rashomon in ways that sometimes makes me wonder if they've actually seen Rashomon, but it's definitely a movie but The Last Duel is a movie that does a really fun thing with perspectives, and ultimately is a great showcase for Jodie Comer most of all. So definitely everyone should go and watch it. And other, like, you know, small movies that were really good, French Exit, I loved from earlier this year. No one's really talking about it because it came out in that weird sort of like, is it a movie from 2020 or 2021 time? But it's really great. Lucas Hedges and Michelle Pfeiffer are just excellent in it. Shiva Baby is just it's like an anxiety attack for 90 minutes, but fantastically so. It's really, really good. I saw The Tragedy of Macbeth. Denzel Washington is, shocking enough as it might be, unbelievable as Macbeth in The Tragedy of Macbeth. It's like, oh yeah, he is one of our greatest actors, and it's like, it's easy to forget that sometimes because he's like making like The Equalizer 3 and stuff, but he's just unbelievable, and the cinematography in this thing is just like spellbinding, like you couldn't imagine. And yeah, so maybe the funniest movie that I saw this year was Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Everyone should watch that. It's really, really funny.
Yeah, I've seen some of those, and they definitely are like toward the top of my list right now. I feel like I haven't seen enough to really give like, you know, other films that that I really love, but there's definitely been a few. I would say The French Dispatch I really liked a lot. Rocks, which I mentioned before. Another international film, a film called Two of Us, from France, a really interesting look at, romance and about, specifically about the dangers of, in this case, the dangers of being closeted and how that affects other people. Some of the most fun I've had, unfortunately, I didn't get to see it in a theater, but I did see it, at home on my TV, and it was still very fun. The Mitchells versus the Machines.
Yes.
So much better than I ever thought it was going to be. And that's what happens when you get real talent to create it. So this is something I feel like everybody would love if they actually saw it.
Yes, I fully agree. It's in my top 20. It's a really, really cute movie. And I mean, I'm a little bit mad at it for stealing all of Luca's award season time, but it's okay. It's a very sweet movie.
Yeah. All right. I guess we'll wrap it up there for now. This is the first part of our 2021 review. We'll actually be talking about older films that we watched for in 2021 in the next episode, and I'm really looking forward to that. Mostly just to kind of look back and see what did I actually watch apart from recent films in the year. So that will be fun, certainly for me. But for now, let's close it up here and let's talk about where we can find everybody. I will start with you, Noah. Where's the best place to find your work online?
Well, in addition to my work here at the Cinema Joes, you should also check out the Pod on the Rooftops podcast, where Justin, my brother Luke, and I went through the whole discography of our favorite band, or my favorite band, Genesis. And you can also check out all of my written work at francenoir.blogspot.com.
Awesome. For me, you can find my work on Letterboxd at Cinemaverick. I also have a website, cinemaverick.com. By the time this goes up, I will have my 2020, yes, you heard that right, and maybe not a surprise at this point, my 2020 in review, where I talk about my favorite performances and my favorite films of that year. As of this recording, my favorite performances is up. I should have my favorite films up before this post, so you can check out both of those. I am somewhat proud of them, I can say. And I think there will be a lot of people that we talked about on this podcast that I proceed to give even more love to. So, yeah, check that out if you can.
You should be very proud of it, Justin.
I wish I'd got it out sooner, but it gets to a point where I'm like, I want to release it, even if it's not maybe the most topical thing right now.
It's an annual tradition at this point for it to come out.
it's yeah. I'd call it belated media, but that's already an existing thing. So
he's not doing too much though. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. How about you, Alex?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can take a look at our Cinema Joes list over on Letterboxd to see all of the films that we give featured reviews to. You can also follow my work on thepopbreak.com. I actually recently released a top 15 TV comic book adaptations for 2021 that finally came out this past week. I'm really excited about that being released because I had to do more work than I anticipated, because turns out, you guys, lots of comic book based television shows out there in the world, and 15 wasn't even enough. I actually watched more than 15, if you could believe it, but only 15 made the cut. And you'll have to go over to thepopbreak.com to find out which one I thought was best, or maybe you could just remember all of the times that I said I really liked it before, and then you might guess. But there's some fun surprises. I definitely liked some things more than I expected, so definitely check that out. Also, over on thepopbreak.com, you can click on the podcasts tab to find all of the podcasts as a podcast editor that I am overseeing and overlooking and contributing to, including Pop Break TV's TV Break podcast, which I also host, and a variety of other things. So definitely check that out. In the name of TV, I do want to briefly say that I just finished watching Station 11, which is a miniseries on HBO Max that aired mostly last year in December. And it's not only the best television show of 2021, but it's one of the best television shows I've ever seen. It's incredible. It's beautiful, beautiful art about art in the most and least pretentious way possible. I mean, if you really have strong feelings about Hamlet, you should watch this show. And if you don't, you should watch it so you get feelings about Hamlet. That's all I could say. It's just incredible. Mackenzie Davis is the lead character. Her and Hamish Patel are both really, really fantastic in it. And it's just out of this world good. So everyone who just listened to me talk about all these movies, and we all talked about all these movies, and movies are so fantastic, but nothing was better in 2021 than Station 11. Everyone should really check that out.
Wow. All right. Yeah. So take that, movies.
Exactly. I hate to say it, but it's just the facts. And if you want to hear us talk about movies more after all that TV talk, you can definitely follow our show at Cinema Joes on Twitter, or subscribe to Cinema Joes wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you for that. Well, we're going to wrap it up there, but we want to thank all of our listeners and our subscribers. Thank you for sticking with us. For now, this is Justin Mancini for the Cinema Joes, signing off.